Do the next right thing to make your marriage sing.
All I ever wanted was to be in love with you. When your eyes met mine, I knew that this was really true.
Hello, and welcome to The Music of Marriage
with Bob and
Evie. We are married, in case you wondered.
I hope so.
We've been married for a while now, and so we have this show, The Music of Marriage, that you may have been listening to before, and we hope that somehow by God's grace, though, you know, life can make us discombobulated like anybody. We can have all this preparation and spend hours and talking and notes and outlines, and then we get there or something happens. We had snow last night, and so we didn't anticipate having to come out and get ice off the windshield so we could see where we were going to drive here. But things happen that throw you off, and we hope that in the midst of all of what we're in life, that through whatever chaos or unexpected things happen that throw us off, that we can all cling to what's going to hold us together underneath of it all. What rock are we standing on? And as we've been telling you since the beginning of this show, or sharing with you, for us and hopefully for you, it is or will become that your love in your marriage is centered on or is stabilized by the rock. And the love that you learn to find out what it is, because it is an ongoing exercise of learning what love is. And I often find, I say to myself, I need to learn a lot more about love. It doesn't come so naturally, but Valentine's Day is tomorrow, and we're going to try and get what is the purpose and proof of love, that it's more than a feeling, and that we really, in order to possess love, we have to prove it. Like, you know, people can say, I love you, but maybe their actions, you know, but we think about there's words, and then there's feelings, and then there's actions. And we often, in the jumble of our natural humanity, all of that crashes together at times, and it doesn't seem like your spouse loves you very much.
And sometimes it doesn't. It seems like you. Well, it's easy to say I love you, but it's difficult often to say I forgive you. But when you say those three words, you are saying I love you.
That's right, because then that turns the ship around. Choppy waters come, you know, in all of our relationships, and sometimes it seems like it's going to capsize. The Love Boat.
Yeah.
Hey, remember that show, The Love Boat? Who was the captain on that Love Boat? Wasn't he a Gilligan's Island guy? Do you remember? The Love Boat. Do you remember that show in the 70s? It was a show.
I can't say that I watched it.
I think it was after Gilligan's Island. It was.
I thought it was the guy on Mary Tyler Moore.
Oh, Dick Van Dyke
was the captain.
No.
Well, in any case, the Love Boat can hit choppy waters, right? We take off on our Caribbean honeymoon cruise, and then, right out of the gate. So, how do we maintain, and how do we, you know, when those times come, that's kind of the proof of the pudding, you know. Even Jesus says in the Bible, it's easy to do what's right when everything's going well. But what about when you're underrested, overworked, underpaid, you know, your wife's getting on your case because you're grouchy, or she's grouchy because of who knows what, not enough sleep, and not enough money, and frustrations of life. So What do we do to set that love boat, you know, sailing and get it out of the choppy waters to where it's smooth?
That's where we need to get
back
to
survive the storms.
Yeah, getting back to the purpose. What is the purpose of love anyway? Do we even think that love has a purpose? Well, it certainly does, and we're going to go over that today. But sadly, I think most people have the mistaken idea that love should be easy. And sometimes it's easy if everything, all the stars line up and you're feeling good.
Well, that depends what love is. If love is only a feeling,
right,
then that's what a lot of, like, the dictionary definition, when you read the definitions, it's just mind-boggling to me, because love is not doing something kind for someone that shows you love them. It's not an action in the dictionary. It's just all feeling.
What does the dictionary say?
Well, it's not worth reading, because it's only about feelings. And I'm like, well, where's the, okay, this is what it says: an intense feeling of deep affection, a deep romantic attachment to someone. So again, feelings, expressing affectionate approval. And of course, in tennis, it's a score of zero, love, which has nothing to do with the other kind of love. I don't know why they call it that. It's interesting in tennis, but there's a lack of any deeper definition than feeling based. And this, more, you know, we need to realize love is more than a feeling, because when the waters do get choppy, you have to have something more firm underneath that you can rely on.
But the tricky thing is that it is also a feeling. And when there is deep romantic attachment to someone, like hopefully your wife or husband, hopefully there's, you know, it is a feeling. And, you know, and that's what it's supposed to be. God also created our feelings. But it is more than just a feeling. And that's, as long as we remember that, the feelings are fine, and we should work on the feelings too, in terms of, you know, putting coal on the fire, fanning the flames of love.
So our actions kind of prove our love, right? So unless we know, and we also, understanding the purpose of love is something we don't often think about. What is the point of love? Why should we love in the first place? What is love? Where do we get our idea of what love is, and how deep it should go, and of how we show one another our love? And, you know, you can show love to people without having a romantic feeling. You love your neighbor as yourself. That's what Jesus said is kind of the summary of the commandments. Love God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. That's not romantic love. That's letting them go first, you know, helping them with something. We know all those kind of ways that we can step up to show kindness and love. Sacrificially, yeah. Even, is sacrificial.
Yes, and fulfilling the commandments, the Bible makes it clear that that's the whole duty of man, loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself. That's the fulfillment of the law, not just the Ten Commandments, but the entire law of the Bible. And 1 Corinthians 13 fits very well into that law. And so
what we have to practically understand is Jesus himself was perfect love. And he came here to demonstrate, kind of give us an idea of what that looks like. First of all, coming here in the first place was kind of a sacrifice for God, you know, who's keeping our hearts beating and, you know, created the universe. To come here, that was just a bit of love right there. It wasn't exactly comfortable. He didn't exactly come to the Ritz-Carlton, you know, and start his life on earth there. He was out in a field, in a place that most women wouldn't be too happy to have their baby and raise a baby in an animal shelter. But the humility and the good works, the good deeds, and the sacrificial deeds of Jesus and the sacrificial life, when he was yelled at, when he was mocked, when he was beaten, when he was whipped, when he was crucified, he never yelled back at people. He never cursed them out. He said from the cross, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." So he is love. He's our creator. He sacrificed. He showed us love, what love is, and the purpose of love, and he proved it. He didn't just send a Bible down to earth. Here you go. There's this glowing book for you to read. He came to demonstrate what love is. So we all have an example, so that on Valentine's Day or any day of the year, when you want to, when you feel like love should be in the air, you know, how do I stir that pot that might be, you know, stagnant, you know, or just unattended to, or things might seem very dead, you know. Think of something nice that you can do for your spouse that's sacrificial, you know, wash the dishes, say something. I don't know. We can all think of something that takes sacrifice on our part, that it will be really clear to them that we love them more than the vows we said back when everything felt so new and lovely. And we make a mistake if we're relying on the feeling part of it, and then our sin comes in, our mistakes, our errors, and our
habitual patterns.
Yeah, patterns that where we're not meeting the other person, and it's like a disconnect. We're creating disconnects in the relationship.
Yeah.
But we this is how we overcome that. It's just by looking back to Christ and saying, "Oh, whoops, I'm off the track. No wonder I've got the wrong wire." It's like Bob brought in his new microphone today, brand new nice microphone, and it, for some reason, the wiring didn't work here, so we had to use the one that is usually here. And
the wiring is misfiring.
So we have to do the work of figuring out, you know, what nice and kind response can I have? And we also have to train ourselves away from those natural responses that we have and not accept, "Well, that's just the way I am." And that's very hard, because our hearts are hard often, and we don't want to hear. We don't want to look at what's in us that needs to change.
And our inclination is to put ourselves before others. But when we get back to love's purpose, that prevents those inclinations from overshadowing our lives and the lives of others, especially our near relations, our spouse, our children, our extended family and friends, etc. So love is, in that sense, not only the unifier of all relationships, when we get back to the real purpose of it and what it means, what it is not, it's not only the unifier of these relationships, it's also a safety net to keep us out of trouble. And in many ways, relationally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And following on the heels of love is the second purpose of love, which is to keep us from destroying one another. And that might sound extreme, but it really isn't, because without love, all you're left with is a destructive force, because it's embedded in evil itself and causes the destruction of families and relationships, and in the process you self-destruct, which is the opposite of what you intended when you were thinking of yourself more than others. I don't say that lightly, because I look to myself as well, and I keep having to bring myself back to center on that point. But yes,
as we all do, right?
Yes, exactly. But and really, Scripture backs what I just said up by saying, where there is selfish ambition, there is disorder and every evil thing. And you know, that is that is an extreme statement. So, and it's a truthful statement, and we have to be aware that when we read something like that in the Bible, that you know, it is God's word; it is absolute truth, and these are part of the absolutes that guide our thinking, that should guide our thinking.
What do you mean by absolute truth? It's there permanently, because God has always been there and always, and it emanates from Him. It's absolute truth. It's not my truth, your truth, His truth, her truth. It's He is.
It's a fixed law, and that's what makes it absolute. Like you know, in physics, the law of cause and effect is a fixed law. You can't deny that law, or the law of gravity, you can't deny. If Newton denied it, we would not know about gravity. But fortunately, an apple fell on his head. Here, Newton, have an apple. Boing. So, anyway.
God has, what is the saying? One moves in mysterious ways. Yeah. Once in a while, we need an apple to fall on our head.
Right.
Oh, man.
Hopefully not a frying pan. An apple will do it.
So what was your point there about Newton, though? What was that point? Because I got, with the apple on the head, I got distracted.
Well, it shook the cobwebs out of his head and got him thinking, why did that apple fall on my head? You know, it was attached to a tree and it just decided to fall. What made it fall? Well, there's this thing called gravity, that it's a gravitational force that pulls everything downwards toward the lowest point, which is why water flows downwards as well.
So it became the law of gravity.
The law of gravity.
Which people recognize, okay, the law of gravity, that's an absolute law. You can't go outside and throw a ball and expect it to go up to the top. Well, but it's going to come down. You know, what goes up must come down.
Yeah.
So just the same with love and God's absolute law. But the thing is that the law is because of love.
Yes.
And so Christ was fulfilling that law because He is perfect love.
Another good law which applies to this is that everything stays in motion unless it's countered by an opposing force.
So like you your spouse?
Yeah, exactly. So if you throw a ball, the opposing force is going to be gravity, it's going to be wind, it's going to be a tree, because you're a bad angel, you know.
See, he knows all this, but I can't understand why he couldn't get his microphone to work.
I don't know, bought this expensive microphone, but maybe he didn't press the on button.
You don't always get what you pay for in this world. Anyway, but
so love is powerful. It's Valentine's Day tomorrow. We we need to jostle our minds and our hearts to think about how do we connect with that force, because love is what brings us unity. It brings peace.
And it's a power.
Yeah.
It's a powerful force. It truly is, and that's why we picked this song of Huey Lewis. It's a little more rocky than some of you might be persuaded to enjoy. But nonetheless,
the words are really good.
The message
of love
is phenomenal.
But I wanted to just mention real quick that love is the best way to show the world what your faith is made of.
Yes.
Jesus said, if you love one another as I have loved you, then you will prove to be my disciples. Not just feelings, right? His love was not based on conditions. He came here, with people who hate him. People still hate God. He's dealing with that all the time. But his love is immovable.
He was committed
immovable.
To his bride.
His love is immovable. And so that's why the song here, The Power of Love by Huey Lewis.
We're back with the music of marriage, talking about the purpose of love.
And I might mention, we have a website, themusicofmarriage.com, and a book called How to Make Your Marriage Sing. It's biblical principles to keep the music playing. Five of them.
Yes.
Only five of the myriad that you could find.
Five important
ones. It's popular to put a number on the cover of a book, and we were debating whether to do it or not. We ended up putting it. But it helped us organize our information. So you can get that book on Amazon or at themusicofmarriage.com. We also have a little player there with songs you can download and radio podcasts so you can re-listen to shows. So we're talking, and Bob's going to take this segment here about the purpose of love.
The purpose of love, we had mentioned before. What was our first point, Evelyn? Do you remember that?
Proving
your love by knowing the purpose of love. But the purpose of love also is to correct the wrong path we are taking. Because what motivation do we have when we are kind of on a wrong path? We're not taking the high road. We're taking the low road in our relationships and getting caught in the thickets and in the weeds. The whole concept of the high road, obviously, is that you're above all that mess and you're kind of free, clear sailing. And G.K. Chesterton, a very interesting, profound author, had a book called Orthodoxy. And he said a few things in there that were interesting. The virtues have gone mad because they've been isolated from each other and are wandering alone. He gives some examples. Obviously, love is a virtue, but other things are virtues as well. What he said is some scientists care for truth, and their truth is pitiless. That is, it's lacking in real love. They're looking for truth in science, but not for the benefit of mankind. See, they're kind of isolating that truth. And the same applies in relationships. If you're looking for truth without a relational benefit, that is a benefit to another person as opposed to yourself. And he said also some people only care for pity, and their pity is untruthful because they act like they care about the things we care about, but they really care about their own power, popularity, and purse strings. So, and some people even have a problem with the Christian virtue of love as described in the Bible because they often think it's mystical or irrational. These are all isolated fallacies where we're trying to isolate virtues in one category or another. Even the whole concept of political correctness is to the exclusion of moral correctness. God, we talked about absolutes that are irrefutable. Well, God made absolutes, and moral absolutes are some of the absolutes he made. And political correctness is not an absolute. It's contrary to what God made. It's an alter universe that people can feel comfortable walking in. And because they don't really want God in their life, they don't want God's idea of love in their life, and so they continue on a path that is going in the wrong direction. Anyway, that said, sometimes we want to show that we care about what is true or right, even as Christians, but are guilty of speaking what we think is true or right without love. The truth can be painful. But if we're critiquing, criticizing, exhorting someone, but with love, it's easier to take a spoonful of medicine. It's easier to go down with the sugar Is that a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
What comes to mind to me is that when you're at odds with someone, your spouse, for example, since this is some show on marriage, but relationally too, or politically. So the Bible says speak the truth in love. But you're not very loving because you have the one person as their view of the truth. No, I did not say that. Or no, you know, the budget should not include that because da-da-da. And the other person says, but because their truth, which is really a non-thing, people shouldn't be saying. There aren't many truths. But you think that the truth is what you think all the time, okay? Whether it's, you know, and that creates arguments, it creates differences, and it creates protests, it creates loud talking, it creates yelling, it creates slamming the door, walking out and turning on the car key and going off in a huff somewhere. It creates a lot of division on a small scale within our homes, within our marriages, to other relationships, and then even in our nation. So when you try to think about speaking the truth in love, but people have their own version of truth, and this can happen on things that aren't as significant as, well, my truth is that God doesn't exist, and your truth is that he does, and he has the moral absolutes that we should go by. But my truth is that that's not true. There you start not being loving, right? Because you start yelling and you start being disunified. You can't get along as a nation with other groups of people in the nation. You can't get along with your spouse in your home, in your kitchen, because now you're angry. You feel, you know, offended or wounded, or how could you think that when this? You have different opinions. We all have different perspectives, and that's fine. To bring different ideas, but it's how do we do it? It's how do we do it? And that's where the love comes in that keeps us unified. Like we said in the first section, mm-hmm. Love is more than a feeling, because not that it isn't a feeling that we should enjoy goodwill. We should enjoy peace in our relationships. And where there's rockiness and roughness, that gets smoothed out when I say, well, I may really be convinced that this is my version of things, and you're really convinced that that's your version. And so you're coming at each other, whether it's in the public square or in your kitchen, you're coming at each other. And whether you're yelling and with signs, or whether you're just, you know, being cold-hearted and disconnected, what is missing? What's missing? Why is the disunity there? What can wash over that and bridge it? What can bring it together?
A bowl of Valentine hearts. Be mine.
Well, if it were only that easy, right?
Yeah, no.
But it's love is the great unifier. So all of a sudden we say, you know what? We're going to speak to one another civilly and kindly. We're going to respect one another, because those are love-based lifestyles. Love-based is proof. Unity in our nation, unity in our kitchen with our spouse on all levels and in between is only going to happen when we subject our behavior to kindness and love. That's
yes.
It. And so,
right.
And God is the one who is love. So that's why our founding fathers said this, you know, here is a republic if you can keep it. We fought for this. Mm-hmm. We died for this. We've wrestled and wrangled and argued here in the Philadelphia, what do you call that hall? Independence Hall. I grew up there, as you know. Now we've got it on paper. We finally have come to an agreement. And there was some yelling. There was some haggling. But overall, what they said is, you cannot remain a nation. You cannot keep this republic unless you have some moral absolutes that prevent you from destroying one another.
That's
where you
exactly
say,
right.
You know what? You're allowed to believe that purple is orange, and I can believe that green is blue. But we have to talk to one another with respect and kindness. Or, even like the Bible says, why do you bite and devour one another? And I think we'll be helped and we'll have a lot more love and peace and happy days again on the large scale in our world. And if we learn how to do that on a small scale in each individual relationship you have where there's not love, where you think of somebody and you go, oh, yeah, that guy. Oh, yeah, that one. Oh, yeah, that president. Oh, yeah, that. Wait a minute. Jesus says, love your enemies, huh? How do I do that, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why the great unifier, I'm digressing. And
yes,
it's important to realize that the practical benefits of love, and it's actually commanded by Jesus, you can have the truth. But if we don't speak in love, and if we make people feel uncomfortable or hurt, if we're rude, if we're inconsiderate and impatient and all of these things, then that kind of makes your truth not very attractive. And Jesus wants us to be attractive to one another by the way we treat one another.
And to agree with one another on that. And practically speaking, if you are in disagreement on that, and often we are in terms of we get into arguments and we're trying to, you know, beat one up each other, basically, and I'm right, you're wrong, and all that stuff, tit for tat, and going back and forth, but so if we continue down that path, that's the wrong path. That leads to protracted arguments and, you know, and some form of division, you know, even if it's temporary. But where the power of love comes in is that when we say, even stop in the middle of what we're doing and saying to one another, say, dear, honey, can we agree on at least one thing right now? And that is, let's stop this. Let's stop biting and devouring one another. Let's stop arguing and just agree that let's just take that step. And then we can move on to other things. Can we at least agree to speak, be nice, to speak kindly to one another and not holler at each other? And start from there and be in agreement and say yes, okay, we'll agree, I'm sorry. And that takes humility, but we often want to avoid those kinds of decisions, which are deeper things that include forgiveness, because we tend to gravitate to retribution, and by using anger and arguments to defend our position, by digging in our heels, even if we know we're wrong, by using the silent treatment and avoidance, things like that. That's completely. That's in the thickets. That's in the mire and mud. So that's where we need to go is taking that high road. And sometimes it starts. It's not a big deal. Sometimes it starts with a single decision. But if you know the purpose and the power of love, that's where those kinds of decisions will guide you, right?
Yes, it's very practical, and it becomes harder if we are, under rested and eating the wrong things, drinking certain things, and that we have to be always assessing that, but the benefits outweigh whatever sacrifices we have to make for the sake of peace. I don't think we can put a price on peace in relationships, just like we can't put a price on peace in our country and in our world. And the thing is, Christ already paid that price, mm-hmm. because he came and kind of showed us the way, and he sacrificed his life. And the under that umbrella is, you know, and through that remembrance of what he did for us, showing us what love is practically, is the way that we will be able to submit and subject ourselves to. You know, it's not about me.
It's a higher standard, and but as Chesterton said, there was a system in place that could do make righteousness and peace kiss each other. Now they don't even bow. Yeah, our world has gone pretty far from the point where righteousness and peace are in sync, basically. And the dislocation of humility, he said, is the cause for that separation. What we suffer from today is humility in the wrong place. A man was meant to be doubtful about himself, but undoubting about the truth. This has been exactly reversed. Nowadays, the part of a man does assert is exactly the part he ought not to assert himself. The part he doubts is exactly the part he ought not to doubt, the divine reason or the truth. But you see, it takes humility to love others the way God tells us to love. And how is that? You know, often we don't really wrestle with those kinds of things, but C.S. Lewis said, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it is thinking of yourself less. And because that's true, a truly humble person will never have low self-esteem. So, you see, humility was largely meant as a restraint of the arrogance and the appetite of man, insatiable appetite. you know, man was always outstripping his mercies with his own newly invented needs. So, and his power of enjoyment destroyed all his other joys. Basically, that's what's happening.
Self-centered.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we have it very easy. We've had it very comfortable in our country with all the luxuries. It's very easy to, I've got my Lazy Boy recliner, got my chips here, my soda on the other side, the remote in my hand. You know, we all look forward into, we love these luxuries that we're so used to, that a couple generations ago certainly wouldn't have dreamed of. And so we're a little bit spoiled. And we're a lot more self, concerned about our own comforts. And we don't have to do, we're not involved in the hard work for survival that our grandparents had to do. And so it becomes easy to have kind of a mindset that's me-centered in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some snow last night, unexpectedly. And so it's still kind of winter time a bit. And we have this song called Song for a Winter's Night by Gordon Lightfoot that actually does talk about some of these issues. Right, Bob?
Right.
The lamp is burning low upon my tabletop. The snow is softly falling. The air is still in the silence of my room. I hear your voice softly calling. If I could only have you near to breathe a sigh or two, would be happy just to hold the hands I love on this winter night with you. The smoke is rising in the shadows overhead. My glass is almost empty. I read again between the lines upon each page the words of love you sent me. If I could know within my heart that you were lonely too, I would be happy just to hold the hands I love on this winter night with you. Fire is dying, now my lamp is growing dim. The shades of night are lifting. The morning light steals across my window pane, where whips of snow are drifting. If I could only have you near to breathe a sigh or two, just to hold the hands I love on this winter night with you, and to be once again with you.
Hey, it's The Music of Marriage with Bob and Evie. On the third segment, that song by Gordon Lightfoot, you know, he has some little jingle kind of sleigh bells at the end there, but don't be fooled. That song is good any time of the year. Right, Daryl?
It's one of my favorites, and I remember he said he wrote it like in the summertime, which
that's right.
It's yes. Hard to believe.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So perfect.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So here we are with Valentine's Day on people's minds, I suppose. And the purpose of love, did you know that the purpose of love is to elevate others? Hmm. Our grandson always says, did you know? Hey, Grammy, did you know? And he's always, did you know? And so I guess it's rubbed off on me. But I think it's a neat way to kind of wake you up to, hey, you're going to learn something. And how much I know I need to learn about love. Mm-hmm. You know, I often say, Lord, there's a lot I need to learn about love. Mm-hmm. That's because there's so much of me in the way. In between love and the other person is me blocking love often with my self-centeredness. And it's so subtle. We're so comfortable with our ways, you know. I always put my stuff there. What do you mean I can't put my stuff all over the dining room table? That's just what I like that, you know. What's wrong with you? You know, you won't let me do this or that. These are these little everyday things that we have to work out lovingly in our home. And that's where we get to practice love. And Bob has an important point to make about that. And it is called, well, first I want to just say real quick, because we only have a few minutes. Love and humility are tied to one another, like Bob said. And how many households, I'm thinking of heads of households, the men in the house take their authority too seriously and are oppressive and unreasonable. And their stuff is all over. Or they're not considering, and it's a two-way street. The wife has her role as well. But we often are oppressing of another person by, we're just like, this is our way. This is what we do. And we have to sensitize ourselves to other people's likes and desires. Even somebody at work, you know. And it's a constant game, it's a constant activity, but it requires doing some reverse engineering, right, Bob?
That's right. Reading some poetry is often helpful, too, especially on Valentine's Day. But the love poets of the 13th century in Florence did this for their readers with their poetry, and this is what I'm going to describe, this whole concept of reverse engineering over lost love. They discovered the mechanics of the process by which people fell in love with to begin with, and so in their poems, what you're actually reading is to reverse engineer or to backtrack basically the process by making an effort to bring your spouse back to the state of being in love, that is, how it felt, how it was at the time, and how you couldn't think of anyone or anything else that was greater than your love for each other. And this Beginner's Guide to Dante's Divine Comedy, this author mentioned about these lyric poets, and so thus he said they tried to create a reading experience that would make their readers sigh, weep, feel warmth, and eventually show compassion. And so the reader is made to enter into the poet's experience of messiness, confusion, or rage, or of melting, burning, sweetness, and peace. In other words, the lyrical poems were, and this is often the case with poetry, are performative. They're the poet's tool for creating in you what is happening in them. So poetry is actually, most people don't think poetry can inspire love, but it really truly does. And certainly love songs are poetry set to music as well. And so that really does the same thing.
That's why I wrote 12 Red Roses in February in the fog. Because, well, actually, was it January? It was snowing here in Franklin, and I was sitting in the car at my Publix waiting for you with the engine running to keep warm, and I was just watching people come out of the store. But it was right before Valentine's Day. It was in February. And I kept seeing, I saw this guy come out with roses, you know, and I thought about how that, the significance of a dozen red roses and how what that symbolizes is a way of showing love. And it's not love itself, but it is in that it's giving. It's what is it an expression of? You know, what might be happening? What would be the reason for these 12 red roses? And so poetry as the music of marriage, you know, music, song, because we're songwriters and creative people, everybody has some of that in them. And it's a neat thing to tap into, you know, if you can put down into words in some way, find some special way to take time out and be quiet, turn off all the electronics and digital stuff and just sit and look at the clouds and write something of what beauty is really in this person that's your spouse, you know.
That's what you look for when you go to the store to get a Valentine's card for your spouse, right? You're looking for what has the most meaning and beauty and romance expressed in words. Well, that's what we should be looking for every day in our relationships.
And expressing in our deeds.
Exactly.
By God's grace, right? So
here's 12 Red Roses, written by Evelyn.
He brought her 12 red roses on a winter's day. He knew her heart was frozen in a desperate way. He feared the path she'd chosen would lead her away. He hoped to melt her heart and make her stay. He played a brand new guitar, pulled back the curtain so she could see the stars, and he promised from now on he'd surely do his part. He wished upon 12 red roses to win her heart. He wished upon 12 red roses to win her. Thank you.
his conscience pricked, he prayed for grace through the 12 red roses. The fire blazed in the quiet warmth. It fixed their gaze as the shadows danced and the music played. Could the spirit of love a brand new love song on her old red guitar. Pulled back the curtain so she could see the stars. And he promised from now on he'd surely do his part. He wished upon 12 red roses to win her heart. He wished upon 12 red roses. Oh,